Welcome to Earth Matters, coming to you today here on Gila Membrus Community Radio, KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic, Executive Director of Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. It's my great pleasure to have Jack Loeffler here with me in the GMCR studio today. Jack is a bioregional oral historian, radio producer, writer, sound collage artist, former musician, and water scholar, a true Renaissance man. Jack's primary concern is restoration and preservation of habitats, focusing on the relationships of indigenous cultures to respective habitats and the role of cultural diversity in attempting to solve the dilemmas now facing humankind. Jack is the quintessential desert rat. He has explored the canyons, deserts, and rivers east of the 100th meridian and the human cultures that have evolved in the Southwest landscape. A close friend of the influential writer and environmental activist Edward Abbey, Jack's biographical memoir, Adventures with Ed, was acclaimed by Booklist as an intimate, incisive, and loving portrait of Abbey that replaces the old brittle caricature with an indelible body and soul vision of a true American original. One of his most recent books, Thinking Like a Watershed, provides us with a variety of cultural perspectives on living in the arid Southwest and how our cultural diversity may be a key to our future as we address water management and environmental problems in an age of climate change and a growing human population. Welcome, Jack.
Thank you so much, Allison. It's a pleasure to be here.
It's great to have you. Thanks for stopping by here on your trip down here to the Southwest. Let's start out. Tell me what a bioregional oral historian is.
Gee whiz, if I could only spell it, I'd tell you. No. The concept of bioregionalism is, the concept was forged back around 1971, and I think Alan von Newkirk was the person who came up with the name, bioregion. But basically, the best definition of bioregionalism I've ever come across was off the top of the head by friend Gary Snyder, who's a poet and a wonderful environmental philosopher from California. Basically, the idea is you get deeper into thinking about habitat than just the natural history of it, but try to experience it on an intuitive level. As Gary would say, really understanding the archetypal aspects of, say, a ponderosa pine or a coyote or a blue jay. But out here, we don't really have blue jays per se. But at any rate, that's the message. And really taking a cue from indigenous cultures. Indigeneity is a big word with regard to this. People whose cultures have actually evolved within the context of the evolution of the habitat itself. And then I spelled aural historian, A-U-R-A-L, because I try to listen to more than just somebody talking about homeland or any of that kind of stuff. I try to record the habitats themselves and also the songs that different cultures come up with regard to habitats, because I've found that music itself becomes a mnemonic device that attaches culture to homeland. To me, that's a big thing. And I've traveled now for just 50 years throughout the American West and Mexico with a tape recorder and a camera and all that kind of stuff. And I've never met a traditional indigenous person who didn't regard the landscape as sacred. And I have to say that our culture has come in, and over the last couple of centuries, we have secularized this habitat of the American Southwest. And so one of the things that I'm really working on as hard as I can is to try to reinvigorate that sense that the indigenous peoples have had traditionally about the sacred quality of landscape, and that it's not something to be turned into money.
Right, and you focus a lot on the sounds, and how did you come to record and be interested in the sounds of these landscapes? I've heard some of your recordings, very beautiful.
Well,
how did you come to be interested in these beautiful sounds?
Not far from here, over in the Rio Grande, is the Bosque del Apache Wildlife Refuge. It's just south of Socorro. And back in 1973,
it's not that long ago, Jack.
I know. It was only 41 years ago. But I had, in those days, I was recording with a Nagra reel-to-reel tape recorder in stereo. And one morning, my wife and I were out there, and we had to have observed about 100,000 birds taking off simultaneously, which to me was a biophony. That's the word that I like. And so I got into recording the birds. And then about, 20 years ago, I was doing a project. One of the things that I do for a living is create what I call sound collages for museums and things like that. And I was doing a project with a friend of mine, Bruce Hucko, who's a wonderful photographer from Moab, Utah. And we were doing the audiovisual presentation for Organ Pipe Cactus National Monument down in southern Arizona. And I was camped out for a week in the Kuyukachwash with my mics out and all of that sort of thing. And the best time to record in the spring is at around first light. And so there I was with my Coleman stove brewing up my first morning cup of coffee. And I had my stereo mics out. And I started hearing alarm calls going from south to north in my field of hearing, so to speak. And I got out the binocs, and I could see a low-flying raptor. I couldn't tell what species it was because it was too far away, but flying from south to north. And as it would hit a certain spot, I would hear the cries of alarm, and I realized that I was hearing interspecies communication that had nothing whatsoever to do with the human species. And that really turned me on. And suddenly I got ever more deeply into listening because there's something going on in there that's just amazing to me. And so subsequently, I started trying to factor that into my sense of the flow of nature and have just been recording away ever since. And it's such a ball. You really get out there. And to me, hearing is the most deeply penetrating of the five senses. And, you know, when we listen to music or even think about the origins of language, we understand that that's where it all began. So I've been out there recording, and I've been having a ball ever since. And so when I make a radio program, say, I use the sounds of that specific habitat of the person that I've been interviewing, say, and I try to create at least a subliminal sense that the human voice is part of the overall biotic community from that particular region. And so that's my approach to listening to wildlife. And it's great. And also listening to water flow, different kinds of waters. It's funny, you record one river and it sounds slightly different than another river.
Interesting. Yeah, I can imagine. So why is it important to collect and preserve these oral histories? Because you have a huge body of work that you have archived, right, in the Peregrine Arts Sound Archive. And so why is this body of work being archived? And is it being used for scientific purposes or?
Well, it's used for a lot of different things. Actually, I have recently donated up till 2005's worth of my recordings to the History Museum in New Mexico at the Palace of the Governors. And they've set up an oral history archive in there. And as time goes on, I'm hoping that my archive will be used by anybody who needs to use it. It was freely given to me, and it's freely available except for sacred songs that the Indian peoples that I've recorded have asked that not be listened to, or the songs of the penitentes, say, who want to keep that quiet. But by the same token, well, let's use the penitentes as an example. Any hermano, any member of the hermandad or the penitenti brotherhood can listen to those songs because those are vital to the recollection of how that culture of practice continues to pursue its practice through time. But there are also hundreds of interviews with different kinds of people from every imaginable walk of life, from gee whiz, from people who speak very broken English or no English whatsoever, talking about their relationship to homeland or just telling the stories of homeland. And those stories tell a huge amount about how the people who came up with those stories relate to the habitat itself. And then getting into interviews with people like, before we started our program today, we mentioned Paul Horgan, who had written Great River, the Rio Grande in North American History, which remains, to my way of thinking, the best history of that region yet written, and recording Paul Horgan back in 1985, getting his hit on the history of the river was very important to me, because if one takes aspects of all of these interviews, one can get a much deeper perspective with regard to a given habitat. In other words, I've recorded people, you know, people born in the 1900s, 1800s, talking about their relationship to homeland and their cultural perspectives. And a lot of those perspectives have gone away, but they're still there to be heard by members of their own cultures to restore as best they can some inkling as to how people saw themselves and how they saw balance and how to live within a state of balance, because that's what's missing in our own culture. We're a culture out of balance. My great friend Godfrey Reggio did a film way back in the 80s called Koyaanisqatsi, Life Out of Balance. And it's a great film. Actually, my friend Ed Abbey regarded that as the greatest documentary film. It's a fantastic film. And so Godfrey actually took his cue from Hopi elders who were talking about how we have made such a mishmash out of today's world because of our total concentration on economics rather than living within the context of our home ecosystem.
You said that this archive is at the Palace of the Governors. How if somebody were interested in accessing or seeing what you have in the archive, how could they access it? Is it online, or do they visit the Palace of the Governors?
Well, at this point, to see the raw material, they'd have to visit the library. It's sort of the photo, now sound archive. And the curator there is a man named Tomas Jahn, J-A-E-H-N. Little by little, as funding comes to them, they're making it so that it's going up online. I actually inherited a 501c3, if you can imagine such a thing.
Wow.
I didn't think you could, but we did. And our dear friend Suzanne Jameson, who lives right here.
That's right, up at Gila Hot Springs.
Yes, she does. And Suzanne was able to take our raw material of a 501c3 and rearrange it, or get it rearranged so that we're now legal. And so our entity is known as the Lore of the Land, Inc., Incorporated. And we have a website at www.loreoftheland.org. And on that website is a place that says audio downloads. And at that point, there are about 51 or two radio programs that can be downloaded in MP3 format. It's not quite as good as WAV file, but you can still hear the words and the birds.
Very good.
And so that's our beginning of trying to get it on the internet.
That's great. Well, we can come back to that at the end of the program. We'll be right back after this short break and continue our discussion with bioregional oral historian Jack Loeffler. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic, your host for today's program. I'm joined here in the studio by Jack Loeffler, bioregional oral historian and author of Thinking Like a Watershed. And this part of our show, we're going to talk about watersheds as commons. And Jack, your book, Thinking Like a Watershed, and the companion 14-part documentary radio series address this notion, which I believe came originally from John Wesley Powell. Is that right? Can you tell us a little more?
Yeah, actually, it was sort of an amazing to me coming together of John Wesley Powell's thinking and Aldo Leopold's thinking. In Aldo Leopold's book, A Sand County Almanac, there's a chapter entitled Thinking Like a Mountain.
Right.
And after having explored the thinking of John Wesley Powell, I realized that for my way of thinking, thinking like a mountain is a little too inert, and thinking like a watershed is right on the mark. Because if you look at a watershed, an existing watershed like the Gila watershed, which is obvious in that you can see the ridge lines on either side, you can see where the headwaters come from, and how the whole thing conjoins as it goes downstream, you can actually see the watershed. The idea is to not just think of the water within the watershed, but to look at imagine as many of the different species as you possibly can, all interacting within the watershed, within the context of the geophysical cradle, And that also includes the atmosphere above the watershed and how the whole thing is an interplay. And so I think it was around 2000, I was doing a radio series called Moving Waters, the Colorado River in the West. And one of the people that I interviewed was a very dear friend of mine, a fellow by the name of William DeBuys, who's one of our great writers in the American Southwest. And Bill was working on a book about John Wesley Powell called Seeing Things Whole, The Essential John Wesley Powell. And Bill turned me on to this map that Powell had rendered back in 1888, 1890, around and through there, when he himself was the director of the USGS, United States Geographic Survey. And they were putting together what they called the 11th Annual Report, 1888-90, to the Secretary of the Interior and to the Department of the Interior, talking about the Arid West. And there was a map of the watersheds of the Arid West that is, to me, one of the most evocative pieces of art I've ever seen in my life. Powell, one of the things I like to bring out is that Powell himself had been a major in the Union forces of the Civil War and had been at the Battle of Shiloh, and a mini ball wound got him right in the elbow and the right arm, and he lost his arm. So I bring out that subsequently he rode unarmed through hostile Indian country of the American West. Bad joke. Anyway. But he had a terrific sense of geography, which is something that I think, gee whiz, to me, the greatest subject that anybody could pursue would be biogeography, because you look at all of the physical, geophysical, biological, atmospheric characteristics of the different regions, and you actually, if you do it like that, you think like a watershed. You see it all in motion. So it requires sort of a non-linear approach to understanding how things all are interrelated. Then you look and you see that the Arid West, that arid, that west that is west of the 100th meridian, that landscape, is divided into maybe 150 watersheds and then their minor watersheds. And this map that Powell rendered shows them in colors, different hues, so that you can actually see these different places. And he actually got it remarkably accurately relative to today's making of maps. At any rate, I'm just so blown away by this map, and here it is right in front of us. And I'll leave a few with you for anybody who might listen to this to come by the radio station or come by your organization, Ellison, to have, because you look at them and suddenly you see a perspective that's not otherwise available to be seen. Powell's whole idea was that the American West should be politicized by watershed rather than this weird amalgamation of states that we have today, these state lines that we have. But the entrepreneurs got to the Congress before Powell could make his point strongly enough. And subsequently, we have New Mexico and Arizona and Colorado and Utah and all of the rest of them. And within them are these watersheds that should have been governed from within. That's the whole concept behind this to me, is that governance should have occurred from within the watersheds, at least a huge part of it. They'd still be, so to speak, owned as much as you can own anything that's land-based by the United States government, because that's the way the government thinks. But there would be a very strong grassroots sense of self-governance coming from the watersheds, so that we would not be as governed from the top down and thereby being liberally governed by the corporate hierarchy of America. And we would be governed from within our watersheds. And so part of my job, as I see it, is to, as vigorously as I can, get people to start governing themselves from within their home watersheds. Because if we don't, we're at the peril of a governing body that really doesn't have the foggiest idea what we're doing with regard to watersheds. And so that's why I've done the book and the radio series and continued to do this stuff, because that's what I do.
Right. And I think you do a good job in the book at highlighting the fact that because, for instance, water development in the West did not follow Powell's vision of management on a watershed scale, we've got problems, major problems, and like, say, the Central Arizona Project. What are some of these problems?
Well, gee whiz, they're enormous. And one of the things that Powell vigorously tried to get across, by the way, I own my own copy of the 11th annual edition of that great document.
So you have the
big book.
I
have the original
map.
Yeah.
Okay.
And I've gone through it very carefully, and my friend DeBuise has gone through all sorts of other articles and stuff. But the upshot is one of the major no-nos is interbasin transfers of water. That's just a bad scene, no matter how you cut it. And what happened with the Colorado River, starting with the 1922 Colorado River Compact that was put together at Bishop's Lodge up just outside of Santa Fe, New Mexico, was how the water of the Colorado River watershed got divvied up between the seven states that are quasi-privy to that water, including Wyoming, Colorado, Utah, New Mexico, Arizona, Nevada, and California. The upper basin was separated from the lower basin at Lee's Ferry, just north of Grand Canyon, actually north of Marble Canyon, and then leading down into Grand Canyon. The upper basin states were, by virtue of being lightly populated, as they still are today, include Wyoming, Utah, Colorado, and New Mexico, the lower basin states being Arizona, Nevada, and California. California got the lion's share of the lower basin. They decided to distribute 7.5 million acre feet to the lower basin, 7.5 to the upper basin. In those days, no Indian nor Mexican was invited to the table. And subsequently, it took quite a while for Mexico to get a water treaty that came in 1944, where they got their 1.5 million acre feet, which adds up to 16.5 million acre feet. And as my late friend Norris Hundley pointed out, the river normally yields 13 to 14 million acre feet. Subsequently, we have built first and foremost the Hoover Dam, formerly known as the Boulder Dam, to be able to create a large reservoir of water that would feed Las Vegas, Nevada, which in those days was just a tiny little spring, basically, feeding into nowhere. But and subsequently, Nevada only got 300,000 acre feet from that apportionment. Arizona was to get 2.3 million acre feet, and they lobbied against that. And so there was the biggest water war in American history that extended from 1922 basically to 1963, when finally the Supreme Court of the United States awarded Arizona its 2.8 million acre feet plus the in-state flow of the Gila. In the meantime, in order to create the ability for the upper basin states to allow the water to get to the lower basin in times of drought, a dam had to be built. And they called it the Colorado River Storage Project Act of 1956. And subsequently, they built the most contested dam in America, the Glen Canyon Dam, which many of us fought even way back then. And I interviewed Floyd Dominey, who brought us that dam. He was my arch enemy back in 1970 when we were doing the Black Mesa Defense Fund and all of this stuff. And then I was in my enraged environmentalist days. And you can relate to that, Allison. Mm-hmm. And he ended up becoming a friend. He was 90-something years old when I interviewed him over in Virginia. He's gone now. And we sat down, and I had my portable recorder and my microphones and everything set up. And there was Floyd Dominey sitting beneath this ugly painting of the Glen Canyon Dam, which was his gift to the world. But because he really believed in what he did, and he had the intestinal fortitude to do what he did, I had to admire him as a fellow human. He believed in what he was doing, just like we all believe in what we're doing. But the upshot is that led to all sorts of interbasin transfers of water. One that I think about vigorously because I live in the Santa Fe, well, near Santa Fe, but I'm in the Rio Grande watershed. The part of the whole series of deals that have gone down after the 1922 compact is what's called the San Juan Chama Diversion, where New Mexico gets one it's supposed to get 800,000 acre feet a year. And the deal went down that 600 and some odd thousand acre feet would go to the Navajo Irrigation Project up near Farmington. Then the San Juan Chama diversion would occur, which allowed 110,000 acre feet. This is an unnatural act to me, to go through a tunnel beneath the Continental Divide into the Rio Chama, which then empties into the Rio Grande, so that Albuquerque and Santa Fe are now counting on water from the Colorado River watershed. And so as we speak, we're looking at a watershed that is going down, down, down due to global warming and climate change. And that has put, as my friend M. Hall, who's a fantastic water lawyer from Albuquerque, used to teach at UNM and has also worked with the state engineer's office back in earlier days. But he says that that puts us in direct competition with Los Angeles, Las Vegas, Phoenix, Tucson. In the meantime, something really came along. What had been imagined way back when, back in 1922, was the Central Arizona Project. Carl Hayden was one of the formulating people in that, but it also involved a lot of contemporary or formerly contemporary politicians, including both Stewart and Mo Udall, who were in support of it. Stewart, who was a very close friend of mine, actually his wife was my last boss back in 1968-69. I've been unemployed ever since. Anyway, but she, and by the way, it was she who bequeathed to me our 501c3. But Stewart told me in retrospect near the end of his life that he had regarded ultimately the Central Arizona Project to be a huge mistake, because what it's doing, originally it was intended to create an irrigation project. It was based on the Salt River Project of around 1913, which actually worked, maybe a little earlier, but it really worked. And the idea was is to bring waters from the Colorado River into the central valleys of Arizona in order to irrigate. Well, that turned into one of the, to me, the worst environmental debacle that's ever been visited upon the American Southwest, the Central Arizona Project. Initially, this just blows me away. They intended, in order to get the electricity to pump the water out of the Lake Havasu, to put dams on either end of the Grand Canyon, cash register dams, dams similar to the Hoover Dam, which generates a huge amount of electricity. And Dave Brower and Martin Litton, both fantastic fellow humans from days of yore and both good friends, vigorously fought that. And subsequently, they got rid of the notion of the dams. That left a coal deposit in northern Arizona on Black Mesa, a place sacred to both Hopi and Navajo Indians. So strip mining of coal, Navajo generating station, power lines, what my wife calls electric kachinas, going from the power plant down to the eastern shore of Lake Havasu, pumping water through a concrete-lined ditch all the way up into the central valleys of Arizona, deeply disruptive of traditional Hopi and Navajo culture, way too expensive to use for agriculture. Very few farmers get to it, but the developers are going, hey, wild. And subsequently, Phoenix and Tucson are metastasizing like mad. And this is all brought to us by money. It's brought to us by corporate control of politicians. It's just an amazing story. And there, I can go on for hours and hours. And this is part of the book that I'm writing right now. It's my sense of the Central Arizona Project.
All right, Jack, we'll be right back after this short break. Stay with us as we continue our conversation with Jack Loeffler here on Earth Matters on Gila Membrus Community Radio 89.1 FM. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic of Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. I'm joined here in the studio by Jack Loeffler, bioregional oral historian and author of Thinking Like a Watershed. And Jack, this book, Thinking Like a Watershed, gives us a range of cultural perspectives on watershed and commons from the Southwest. And I'm wondering, how do New Mexico's indigenous cultures define a watershed? It seems to me it's much more comprehensive than our sort of Western scientific definition.
Yeah, as a matter of fact, apropos of what you're just saying, I think that science alone is not going to solve our problems. It's going to take a lot of input from people whose perspectives are much more inclusive. Reductionist thinking does not go along with thinking like a watershed. Thinking like a watershed is supposed to bring in as many different aspects of understanding anything as possible, so that it's a metaphor for perceiving things whole, the whole picture, which is something that the indigenous peoples that I know are totally adept at. Over the years, I've had the great good fortune to work with an awful lot of Native American people, and I include Hispanos in that because for 20 generations constitutes indigeneity, as far as I'm concerned anyway. But at any rate, one of the great wise fellow humans in my lifetime is a wonderful lady born into the Tewa culture at Santa Clara Pueblo up on the Rio Grande by the name of Rena Swensel. And many years ago, my phone rang, and I answered, and there was Rena asking. We'd never met before, although we had been aware of each other. And she asked me if I'd take my tape recorder out to Santa Clara Pueblo and record her mom singing Tewa children's songs. And I was deeply honored to do that. And we became great friends. And little by little, I started to interview on numerous occasions. I've interviewed Rena, and her sense of what a watershed is, her perspective with regard to how everything fits within it, including the human species, but understanding the kinship with all other species. And even the kinship with the rocks and the water and the wind. One of her favorite phrases is po-wa-ha, which means water, wind, breath. And those three words represent the entire perspective to Rena. She thinks that the whole thing is wrapped up in those words, and I can understand that because it truly reflects our interrelatedness and the relatedness of all things to each other. And what has really gotten me is that I've spent time with diverse cultures here in New Mexico and all over the West, actually. There's one radio series I produced called The Spirit of Place that took me through the 11 Western states. And I just concentrated on talking to as many different Native American people as I could. And gee whiz, it was just amazing to me, the depth, the breadth of everybody's perspective. It was just, it was infinitely more inclusive than anything I have ever seen. Now, a lot of these people are well-educated within the context of Western science, et cetera, et cetera. But by virtue of being tapped into their own cultural roots, it's as though there is a whole flow of mind that seems to have atrophied in a culture that has been so dominated by economics as is our own. In other words, we have become so linearly oriented. And so this book, Thinking Like a Watershed, and the radio series, Watersheds as Commons, we try to include as many of the perspectives as possible. Rena has written a chapter for the book. Lyle Balenqua, who is a Hopi man with a master's degree in archaeology, and he's also the director of the Native American River Runners Association, somebody that you should speak with and connect with. And then Roy Cady, who is a Navajo traditional person, brilliant mind. He's a weaver, which is a rarity. Usually the weavers are women, but he's a great weaver. And he also has a mind that weaves together concepts in a beautiful pattern. It's just a beautiful person. And then another Native American person is, well, the Gila River goes right through the Tohono O'odham Nation. And Camilus Lopez is just one of the most brilliant people I've ever known as well. He expresses his thoughts and how, and he too has a foot in both worlds, but he understands the relationship of Tohono O'odham culture In other words, he perceives how the culture itself was shaped by the evolution of the Sonoran Desert. One of the things that's very interesting to me is that at the end of the Pleistocene, the Sonoran Desert wasn't what it is today. It was probably pinon juniper grassland. And with the warming trends of the Holocene epoch, cultures, human cultures, I think there's evidence of Clovis points down in that desert. It indicates that humans have been there for at least 12,000 years, intermingling with the desert. The culture is evolving slowly. Hohokam culture was there. And then today, Tohono O'odham culture is there. And the Tohono O'odham people see themselves as having evolved, as the habitat itself evolved, which is true. And gee whiz, when you think about that, it just boggles the mind. That sense of relatedness to culture itself. And then another person in this book, oh boy, Esteban Arellano is an amazing fellow human. He lives up in Embulo, New Mexico. He knows more about acequias than any other person that I know of. Actually has a new book coming out through UNM Press about his understanding of acequia culture and how much of Spanish/Hispano culture was shaped by Moorish culture, because in 711, the Moors took over Spain and were finally expelled in 1492, which is when many of the people who are the forerunners of today's Hispano culture in New Mexico arrived. And 20 generations ago, basically, 1598 is when they actually established a colony here, and they intermingled with the Native American people in the region, and it was both an intermingling of blood and culture, the mestizaje. That's where the word mestizo comes from. It's a wonderful concept. But at any rate, the people of the northern Rio Grande, the Hispano people up there, which is a culture unto its own, La Raza, have a deep, profound understanding. Their whole system of politics was based on water and the acequia system. Acequias are irrigation canals. And they restore the watershed. In other words, many people, even today, don't understand that there's surface water and there's groundwater. The groundwater is the aquifer part of it. The surface water is the Gila River, the Rio Grande, the Pecos, the different rivers that we have, the very few. It turns out, I read this somewhere, probably in an article I wrote myself, so it must be true. But at any rate, New Mexico has less surface water than any other state, relatively speaking, which is very interesting to me. Then we have Anglo culture, which came in the early to mid-19th century. And so many of the people who were the people who came in at that time, say five generations ago, were accustomed to the way it is east of the 100th meridian, that dividing line that runs right down through the middle of our country, east of which is very verdant, it rains a lot, west of which it is dry and it doesn't rain much, raining less by the day. And so in came the cattle, and we overgrazed a lot. And there are records from that period of time that talk about how when people came through, they could drive their wagons right through and there would be no underbrush to go through because the natural fire system, the natural regime was still happening. And my good friend Sid Goodlow, who owns a ranch over near Carrizozzo, is also in this book. And his chapter in the book is based on an interview that I did with Sid, who is an amazing thinker. He is actually the person who brought Alan Savory from Africa over to the Southwest. And Alan Savory came up with a holistic approach to cattle, which means don't have more cattle than the ecosystem can carry. And also make sure that the cattle go from pasture to pasture rather than being in the same place year in and year out. And little by little, a whole new philosophic system has occurred in ranch culture, and Sid Goodlow is very much at the heart of it. And he has had an enormous effect. Actually, he's a really good man. I visited his ranch, which he bought. It was what my buddy Ed Abbey would call a cow-burnt ranch back in 1956. It was really a dead zone. And over the last half century plus, Sid has restored that to a beautiful ecosystem, very much as it had to have been in the early 19th century. So these are some of the people in the book. And also includes, this book also includes some other perspectives. For example, Sonia Dickey, great young lady who just got her PhD in history, wrote a beautiful chapter, which I'm hoping you'll really enjoy, about the Central Arizona Project. And then there's a bit from Stuart Udall in here talking about his perspective with regard to these things. And then Gary Paul Nabhan, superb ethnobotanist who lives over in southern Arizona, great contributor. And then Bill DeBuys himself. And then my daughter, Pettigrina, talks about all sorts of fine things in here. And so basically these are what I'm trying to do in this book, or what we have tried to do, because Pettigrina and I did it together along with a radio series, was to put together as many different perspectives as we could find that conveyed how to proceed within homeland.
And really, your thesis is this cultural diversity is really the key to how we should move forward to address our water issues in our watersheds, that really this cultural diversity is a strength, right, that really holds perhaps the key solutions to moving forward.
To me, boy, this hit me like a ton of bricks one day, a long time ago, but cultural diversity and biodiversity are inextricably interlinked. You just don't have one without the other. And we as a species, we're so diversified. But in mainstream culture, by virtue of our fascination with economics, we've excluded so much that is profoundly, profoundly important to us. So we have to involve indigenous mind.
That's right. So we'll be right back with Earth Matters after this short break. Stay with us. Welcome back to Earth Matters here on KURU 89.1 FM. This is Allison Civic of Gila Resources Information Project, and I'm your host for today's program. I'm joined here in the studio by Jack Leffler, bioregional oral historian and author of Thinking Like a Watershed, and producer of the documentary radio series Watersheds as Commons. And Jack, I've been really enjoying reading your book Adventures with Ed, and you have done a biographical memoir of writer and activist Ed Abbey. And he said, one quote I read in the book, society is like a stew. You have to keep stirring it so that the scum doesn't rise to the top. I love that quote. And I'm wondering, what have your experiences been in stirring the pot of society as you have dealt with environmental issues and dealing with all these complex issues like water in the West throughout your career?
Wow. Well, you know, one of the things that it's interesting to me is that I no longer remember. It's been, a long time, 50 years of active duty, so to speak, and there's just a huge amount I don't remember.
Maybe that's a blessing and a curse, right?
Well, I used to think that amnesia and enlightenment were the same thing, frankly. But no, it's been a fantastic time the whole time. And I remember, for me, that whole sense of relating to place, the flow of nature is the way I perceive it. I started to snap to it very early on as a little boy, really. And it's just been with me. That's part of my modus operandi, actually. One of the things with regard to Ed, he and I actually met when I was a waiter bouncer in a bar in Santa Fe back in 1962. And that's when we first connected. But we didn't really realize what we were both into until a few years later when we were both trying to thwart this whole business of coal-fired power plants throughout the American Southwest. And I started the Black Mesa Defense Fund with a couple of pals, and Ed and I did a lot of research together out on Black Mesa that resulted in his book, The Monkey Wrench Gang. And little by little, we realized that we felt very similarly about, well, I had started to write a book called The Man Who Shot Machines.
Mm.
And as I said earlier, Ed is beyond the statute of limitations. So, but we really got into it big time. And we spent much of our friendship. We were best of friends for a very long time. And we camped all over the American Southwest. We ran rivers together. We really got into it. And we didn't agree on everything, but one way Ed was a born anarchist. This is something that's really, he wrote his master's thesis entitled The Morality of Violence. I have his original master's thesis at home in my files. He actually gave me an original manuscript of the Monkey Wrench Gang as well, because we were really doing research together big time. And he's right. Society is like a stew, and it really does have to be stirred. Otherwise, you got today's politicians in collusion with today's corporate moneymakers. And the degree to which our politics is controlled by money is extraordinary. And that's why we have to stir up the grassroots as hard and as deeply and as fast as we possibly can within home ecosystems or home watersheds. Because in an ideal state, we should be self-governed. That is the highest level of democracy. Actually, I've spent a fair amount of time really researching anarchist thought. I have two great friends in my lifetime who were fantastic anarchist thinkers, Ed being one of them and the poet Gary Snyder being the other. And they never met. They wrote back and forth to each other, but they never met. And our big dream was the three of us go run a river together, because I was the only one who understood both of them. Actually, Gary's a very close friend, and we work together all the time. We're doing a project right now on the practice of counterculture and the role of counterculture in the modern environmental movement, which is really interesting and profound. It really is. And that's one of them. It just goes on and on and on. There's just so much stuff. But you have to keep stirring it up. And I think that's everybody's job who becomes an elder, is to relentlessly keep stirring and stirring and stirring, because as we know, there are young people among us who are going to supplant the scum at the top and really create a healthy future. I have to say that that's where my hope lies. I've spent time now working with a lot of young people over a very long period of time. And there is a sense of optimism. There's a sense of activism that needs to be invigorated on some fundamental level. All they need is seeing the bigger picture in a little way in order to blossom within it and make it ever bigger and really create a solid activist perspective that will affect in a good way. In other words, those of us who are stuck in our lifetime of mores have a lot to learn from young people who have yet had that system of mores that they have to wade through to get to reality. This is one of the toughest jobs in one's own life, is to be able to take that system of mores into which one is born and break it apart and look for the truth and then live there and let the old stuff go away, the stuff that doesn't belong anymore. In other words, the human species is suddenly being revealed to not be the reason to be, but rather something that has taken a perfectly healthy planet and turned it into another sort of an ecosystem. And we are rapidly approaching a place where the ecosystem could very readily result in another biotic community worldwide that would be its own form of paradise, but it would be excluding us as a species.
Mm-hmm. Now, do you think that we could have, is there evidence out there that we're making this paradigm shift to thinking like a watershed? Do you think there's hope? I'm thinking, the Gila River issue and the fact that, you know, what's on the table right now is doing exactly what you described the Central Arizona Project is doing, you know, piping water one or two basins over. And I'm just wondering, are given what's happening out in the world and how there's evidence all over of how bad that thinking is, how bad that paradigm is, Is there evidence that people are thinking differently about water issues, about environmental issues, and shifting their mindset to think more like a watershed?
There is, to me. I have to say this. becoming an activist back in the 60s is there weren't that many activists back in the 60s. And there are a heck of a lot more now, and there's a heck of a lot more environmental awareness now. But by the same token, I noticed that great organizations like the Nature Conservancy have as their board of directors people from Goldman Sachs and everybody else. And so this is another form of corporate takeover that I do not like at all. And this is why we have to keep everything we do small within our own small groups of people who cannot be corrupted, who cannot be shifted into another paradigm. The system of being dominated by economics is dead wrong. It really is. And to me, the biggest problem right now is not even global warming and climate change. It's global attitude. Unless we shift global attitude into something that has to do with ecological soundness, ecological well-being, understanding what ecology really means, understanding what living in your home watershed really means and keeping it healthy and not doing anything that really violates the principle of a healthy ecosystem. Therein lies the real rub right now. And until we get that solved, we don't really have much in the way of hope. It's us right now. We have to shift it ourselves. We have to just be relentless, stay relentless, shift it ourselves, and we'll see what comes down the pike.
So, Jack, as we close here, I have to ask you, as an activist and preserver of our natural and cultural history, where you're sort of in this race against time, and I'm wondering, how do you keep going? How do you find joy when there's so much bad news around us? Species extinction, loss of wild places. You've been at it, you said, for 50 years, and you have such a wonderful, happy attitude. And so I'm wondering, what's your secret? What are your words of wisdom to keep going, keep up the good fight?
My second favorite fortune cookie of all time revealed to me that enthusiasm charms brutes, it tames beasts. You have to stay enthusiastic. It helps to drink good coffee, I'll say that.
Thank you, Kyle.
But it also, it helps to be out in it as much as you can. If you can get out in it and actually feel the flow of nature going through you, it is truly, that's as good as it gets, because you really feel it, you understand it, you realize that you're hooked into the rest of the universe, or multiverse as the case may be, and we're such a tiny little part of it all. But gee whiz, we have this opportunity to be joyful in this incredible place. And boy, that sure beats the alternative.
Sure does. Sure does. Well, thank you for providing us with your words of wisdom and really an amazing body of work and these cultural histories, oral histories. It's such an impressive contribution to our state, to the Southwest, to civilization. I really appreciate it. And I do want to remind people how, if they're interested in getting more information, access to all the wonderful programs you've done, can you give us a web address?
Okay, our website, it's our Lore of the Land website, which will get more and more, I hope. I hope it'll get better, but it's www.loreoftheland.org. And you find audio downloads there. You can see the books that have come out of it and different things. And I just think that everybody can have an awful lot of fun learning about the lore of their own homeland. It's been a lot of fun. So thank you.
Thank you, Jack, for talking with me today. This has been a great, fun conversation. So thanks to our audio engineer, Kyle Johnson, and thank you for tuning in to this week's program. I'm Allison Civic, and I hope you'll join us again for next week's edition of Earth Matters here on Gila Mimbres Community Radio 89.1 FM.